What time are we? A little after 9 a.m.
9 a.m.
July 1. Open the work session on House Bill 2009.
Chair Chris.
You've got the amendments.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, House Bill 2009 was heard on the 28th and again on the 30th. And this is the bill that would require the Department of Human Services, when a child has already been placed in the department's legal custody and the department is adopted a plan of adoption, to first consider the child's grandparents or other birth relatives as prospective adoptive parents before considering other non-relative adoptive parents. At the direction of the committee, I obtained the proposed Dash 1 amendment that is in your packet that provides a right of judicial review to an agency decision to pursue adoption of the of a child who was in its custody to non-relatives. The way that LC drafted that right of review was to key it into an existing statute, which exists at 183484. That is within the Administrative Procedures Act. It's the procedure for judicial review of a case, or excuse me, of an order other than a contested case. The other thing I did at the direction of the committee was obtained an opinion from Legislative Council in response to concerns that were raised at the hearing about whether or not the bill, House Bill 2009, presents any conflict with ORS 419B116 and ORS 419B192, which respectively are the intervener statute and the statute that requires preference of immediate placement of a child with a relative. And I do have an email from Doug McKean at Legislative Council that indicates after discussing it and analyzing the issue with Virginia Vanderbilt, he concluded that the bill does not present a conflict with those two statutes.
Representative McPherson?
Yes, I have a question of counsel. One of the issues that came up in our prior in the hearing was comparing the language in this proposed amendment to the adoption provisions with the standard for placement for children who are taken into protection under by DHS. And I'm just going on memory now for what that standard was, but as I recall, it had there was a different standard. It referred to relatives, but it also referred to people who have a caregiving relationship with the child. And it would seem as though even if we're not talking about DHS overseeing adoptions, that would seem to be the more appropriate standard to me to consider both blood relationship or legal relationship, but also caregiving relationship. Can you refresh me on that?
Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, I think your point is accurate insofar as I think that was the history of the conversation that we were having. The issue that I asked LC to look at was slightly different. I think the point you're making is a very principled policy decision that's got to be made about whether or not there are two different circumstances. One is the placement of the child when the child is removed from the family, and that is the 419B statute. And right now the 419B statute says that when DHS is placing a child outside the home other than with the parents, that it must give priority to relatives or individuals who have a caregiver relationship. And there we noted that there was a bill that came out of the Senate that has passed both chambers that slightly changes that caregiver relationship statute. So that is the one that exists. And then this bill, 2009, amends the statute that concerns the preference, if any, that is going to be given when DHS is making a determination as to that the child is going to be put up for adoption. The parental rights of the parent are going to either be terminated or relinquished, and they are making permanence. DHS is making permanency plans and identifying an adoptive placement. So the legal issue is there, does the standard need to be the same? If 2009's proposed standard is slightly different, preference to grandparents and other relatives, does that present a legal conflict with the 419B, which says preference to relatives and caregiver relationship? And the legal answer is no. Whether or not you want to make that the same as a matter of policy is completely up to you. I think there are different issues at play when you're talking about a placement following removal from the home as opposed to placement for adoption purposes. I think that the majority of placements outside the home upon removal of a child are temporary. Most, I shouldn't speak out of school, there are folks here who can who probably have data to back this up, but when we're talking about placement out of the home following removal, that does not indicate that that is going to be a permanent placement, whereas the adoption placement is going to be a permanent placement, and there may be different considerations based on the fact that those are just different circumstances that you may want to consider.
Right. I understand that it's not a legal conflict. We could decide we were going to have a different policy on the preference given when we're placing children initially, when they're taken under the protection of DHS, than we make upon permanent adoption. But as a policy matter, I don't know why we would. It seems to me that you'd have the same considerations for the long term when you're changing the legal relationships between the children and whoever's going to be their adopted parent. Then you would make any different choice there than you would when DHS is taking the child under protection. You mm-hmm. give weight to both family relationship and a caregiving relationship.
Okay. Any comment? Joe, regarding the last sentence, talk to us a little bit about the judicial review, please.
The statute that is cross-referenced for purposes of judicial review is 183484, and this is the statute that governs review of orders other than contested cases. The process of my reading of the process is that the jurisdiction for the review is in the Circuit Court of Marion County or upon the county where the petitioner resides, that is, the aggrieved person. The petition for review has to be filed within 60 days following the date of the order. My read of this and application and dependency cases, I think that would mean the order of the court to proceed with adoption. That may be one of the orders. It's a little more it is an agency decision as to assigning who is going to be the prospective adoptive placement, and that would probably be the other level at which a relative would be able to trigger this petition for review. And then the petition itself has to lay out the reason the petitioner is dissatisfied with the agency action and the requested relief. The court then may, once it gets the petition, may either affirm, reverse, or remand the order. If the court finds that the agency has erroneously interpreted a provision of law and that a correct interpretation compels another outcome. the court can also remand the order if it finds that the agency's discretion was outside the range of the discretion that is delegated to them by law, if the agency order was inconsistent with any agency rules, or if the agency order was otherwise in violation of a constitutional or statutory provision. And then finally, the court can also set aside or remand an order if it finds that the order was not supported by the substantial evidence in the record. These are all relatively deferential standards to agency decisions, as is the general rule with appealing agency decisions. The petitioner asking for a reversal of an agency decision usually has a pretty high burden to show that the agency is acting outside the scope of its authority.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions?
I'm concerned because I'm thinking there could be a case where I'm raising a nephew, or my wife's nephew, for example, and something happens to my wife, and the true parents of this kid don't like the grandparents. I don't like the grandparents. They're atheists. They drink. They smoke. They're just not nice people, but they're not criminals. And suddenly, this kid that I'm raising goes to them pretty much automatically. And that's why I want that cure. I think the cure provider provision that's in the other piece we ought to have in this piece. I don't want to deprive grandparents from their grandkids, but I can see cases where the grandparents, from my point of view, if I'm raising this kid, I don't want the kid to go there. Maybe the kid can't stand them either. I mean, and this says that they get first crack, and I'm uneasy with that.
You're uncomfortable.
I am indeed.
Communicating
the language of the other statute.
You have any comments on
that? Mr. Chair, I mean, my only comment is I understand what Representative Barker is saying. I say it says first consider, and I mean, it's not first right of refusal like in contract law. It's first consider. And then the second thing is of course, there's the one thing that I'm just appalled that we don't have is a review process. And in your case, if the example you gave, then there would be a judicial review process to a court. I mean, in a system across the world where, you just go in and snatch things, do it, and there's no recourse. I mean, that's what we call communism and socialism at its worst forms. And so the judicial review process, I think, would address that. I understand the concerns you have. No two ways about it.
If we had language in there to talk about the caregiver, other caregivers, I think I wouldn't have a problem, though. I mean, that's my problem, because this tends to exclude them. If it's not in here, the court's going to say it's not in here because the legislature didn't want the caregiver given to be considered. They only wanted the blood relatives and the grandparents. It's the way that's the way the Court of Appeals would read this later on. That's my concern.
Representative Flores, does that make sense?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think, again, to Representative Barker's example, I don't disagree that if there is an established, ongoing, nurturing, emotional and psychological well-being attachment, that a caregiver who is not a blood relative or a grandparent should be left out of the loop. I think that what we have heard from a considerable number of folks, and we see oftentimes, is that those aren't the considerations that are made, and that there are grandparents who are being what would appear to be arbitrarily and capriciously left out of that evaluation or determination and process.
I don't want that either, but I don't want them to be. I mean, without it, unless we include the caregivers are going to be excluded. That's my grave concern here. If we could fix that piece, I think I could support it.
Do we have a copy of the statutes here?
Wait, Chair Cooley, Representative Boquist, I do.
On the 109 section.
Oh, sure.
109.305.
I can get you that one, too.
To 109.310, which we're amending. There wasn't a set. I didn't find them. There they are. Okay.
Meanwhile, I was looking up the 419B116 statute to give you the actual language that the statute uses for purposes of a caregiver relationship that has a right of intervention or to seek intervention in a juvenile case. A caregiver has that right as well to a relative. And under the other statute in 419B, which is the priority or preference to placement with relative or caregiver, and I note that the bill, Senate Bill 229A, is the bill that amended the one of those statutes to make the caregiver relationship language the same in both. That bill has passed both chambers and is on the way to the governor. So the definition of caregiver relationship is a relationship under the statute, and I'm reading this out of 419B116, is a relationship between a person and a child or ward that has existed during the year preceding the initiation of the dependency proceeding, or for at least 6 months during the dependency proceeding, or for half of the life of the child or ward if the child or ward is less than 6 months of age. It is also a relationship between a child or ward in which the person had physical custody of the child or ward or resided in the same household as the child or ward. It is a relationship in which the child provided, the person provided the child or ward on a daily basis with love, nurturing, and other necessities required to meet the child or ward's psychological and physical needs, and in which a child depended, on which a child depended to meet the child or ward's needs. The definition does not include a relationship between a child or ward and a person who is a non-relative foster parent of the child unless the relationship continued for a period of exceeding 12 months. So that is the definition of caregiver relationship currently existing in the intervention statute, and by virtue of Senate Bill 229A, will also be the same definition for purposes of the placement statute.
Mr. Chair, that's a fairly elaborate definition, and to repeat that all in this statute might be a bit cumbersome, so that it might be an efficient use of language to cross-reference it. But if we were to amend the bill so that it referred to shall first consider the child's grandparents, comma, other birth relatives, comma, or caregiver as described in, and then reference the section that counsel just read, that would get the whole group of people who are potentially to be considered then within the reference here.
I think that would give Mr. Chair, I think that would give the grandparents what we're trying to do as well here. I don't want people being reviewed. And I don't want the anecdotal stories you heard concern me greatly where the grandparents are essentially just pushed aside. I don't want that at all. But I don't want, this is the kind of explanation I gave. I mean, I can think of cases where I know people who say, I wouldn't have let Mike, you know, I mean, they make special wills to have a cousin raise their kids or something, which I did. My wife and I, together with other family members, I mean, these are, you know, kind of distant blood, but they had the same values we had. They raised their children the way we were raising our children, and so we both had an exchange will that if something happened to the parents, the other family would adopt the children and take them and care for them and so on. Not that the grandparents were particularly evil, but they were older and everything. So anyway, I just want to have the caregivers a piece of that in there to protect them as well. But I'm not trying to exclude the grandparents at all. I think that's
Rosie Flores.
Thank you. Question for counsel on clarification. When you read this, the point regarding non-relative foster parent, can you rewind that a little bit for me?
Sure. Chair Krieger, Representative Flores, the definition of caregiver relationship has an exclusion built in at 419B116, and that is that a caregiver relationship does not include a relationship between a child or a ward and a person who is the non-relative foster parent of the child or ward unless the relationship continued for a period exceeding 12 months. So there's an exception, and then there's an exception to the exception. Caregiver relationship does not count if the relationship is with a non-relative foster parent, but it does count as to a non-relative foster parent if that relationship continued for more than 12 months.
So, Mr. Chair, so Council Land now would just put them in the in the mix. It wouldn't give them the lead if they had the foster parent who's been over 14-month foster parent wouldn't automatically precede the grandparents in this thing. The grandparents would still have the review if it went the other way.
Chair Krieger, Representative Barker, I think that the way the bill is crafted, there's no priority among the individuals that are listed. I think the bill, now I've lost the bill itself in my papers, but I think the bill says, thank you. I think the bill says that DHS shall first consider the child's grandparents or other birth relatives, as Representative McPherson has suggested, we could draft or other persons described in 419B116. That does not, the use of the or does not suggest any pecking order, if you will. I think it's any of the above.
And okay, that, so I think they would work with the appeals portion, so that a grandparent would have a second bite at the apple.
Representative, you have a question.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I mean, Representative McPherson, I actually talked a little bit about this, and when we're in the adoption process, and this is a problem I have with what Representative Barker is saying. I agree with him, but I have a problem with it. Is that when we get to the adoption process, we're down the road. We're quite a ways down the road, and it immediately jumps out at me as a red flag. We may be more than 12 months down the road, and so here we are in a situation in the case we saw before us where this may have happened more than 12 or 14 or 16. This may be ongoing for 2 years, and at that point, based on this definition, the foster parents or whoever they were that were not blood relatives may qualify as the caregiver now, and you, in your case, Reverend Barker, are going to go to court because they got them. And so the problem I have with the caregiver definition is that foster, you know, when it gets to the 12 months.
The exclusion
is when we get to that 12-month period, in most of these cases, these are long, drawn-out cases. These don't happen in 12 months. And we're institutionalizing the previous two sections we had problems with, which we could not change, where, you know, the grandparent's not in there. So we could be at 2-year mark, and suddenly, in the case you brought up, it might not go your way, and you got to go back into the judicial review. And that's the concern I have with that definition of caregiver. It's that, you know, we've already institutionalized it from two previous sections by foster care, and here we are. So I'm not sure we even do anything by doing this bill if we put that in.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what troubles me about the exclusion of a non-relative foster parent language in this process is oftentimes we hear, and I heard testimony in House Education Committee in regard to some foster care issues, that there are multiple placements made and children are in, from what appears to be good living arrangements and have established some bonds with their foster parents, and yet they are placed, numbers of removed and replaced, and there's a continuous disruption. That's problematic, but I think going back to the non-relative foster parent, there are a lot of foster parents who have established some long-term good relationships on the other side of that that would be automatically excluded from this consideration. So I'm
in the way it is now.
Yes. The language in 419B116. So my concerns now are growing in regard to not only giving consideration to grandparents, but some long-term relationships that have been established and or that have been disrupted from allowing those relationships to establish. Help.
All right, help me here, Representative Flores, you lost me here. But correct the council if I'm wrong. What we're saying is that if they have been in a foster relationship longer than 12 months, they then qualify as a caregiver. So therefore, they have established a long-term relationship with which Representative Flores just mentioned, and you lost me from there.
Well, based on, and I'm sorry, I know it seems elliptical, but we've heard testimony that sometimes those foster placements are not allowed to develop. And there are children that seem to be doing very well in a particular given foster relationship, but they're uprooted and moved on for whatever agency purpose and decision was made to do that. So there has not, and people, foster parents have come and said, we love this child. We want to be able to maintain this relationship and even perhaps even move to adoption, but they haven't been allowed to even establish that long-term relationship as defined in our statute. So there's
a can of worms.
It is a can of worms.
Mr. Allure.
Chair Krieger, I was just advised by Ms. Ledesma from DHS that there is a bill, which I am not staffing, I was not aware of, Senate Bill 815, that would further amend the definition of caregiver relationship, and that 12-month provision as to foster parents, it would reduce to 6 months, thus making the time even less than under current statute. I don't know the status of that bill. Ms. Ledesma believes it's still being worked and has not passed. Mr. Travis is indicating that he knows the status of the bill.
Senate Bill 815 was developed by Senator George, and I worked with him and gave him technical support on that. It has passed the Senate committee, and it is on its way to the Senate floor, and that's the status of it right now.
What's the name? Thank you.
Chair Krieger, if I could just kind of recast, I want to make sure if I'm directed to get amendments, I want to make sure I understand, and maybe I'll take the liberty of trying to recast the conversation to make sure I'm on the same page. But I think the issues we're discussing is, one, for purposes of the bill itself, giving an adoption preference to grandparents and other relatives, and the consideration is adding the definition of caregiver relationship to that preference list. And then a second issue is has to do with the Dash 1 amendment, which is the right of judicial review. And I think it's a secondary issue of whether or not we give that right of judicial review to grandparents, birth parents, and caregiver relationship. And the committee may decide that it does not want to extend that right of judicial review to people with caregiver relationships. Or it may decide it does want to, and there might be pros and cons to doing it. If you do it, you're going to have, potentially you're going to have foster parents who are in a position to delay the finality of an adoptive placement. That might be a good thing in some cases. That might be a bad thing in some cases. And if you don't do it, you're going to have an apparent inconsistency in who is eligible to have the preference or to be considered first for adoption, and then exclude one class of those folks, the caregiver relationship folks, from being able to review an adverse decision or seek review of an adverse decision. And I think that's where the conversation is at.
Yeah, it does seem inconsistent to me to describe a certain group of potential adopters in the first part of the bill, and then not all of those same people in the remedy that we're creating for judicial review. It would just seem like we're making an odd choice there. So it would seem to me what we're doing here is we're creating first consideration rights for certain people, and those people then would have a right to get the court to look at the decision.
Just. Yeah, once again, not all grandparents are Wayne Kriegers is the problem. I mean,
oh, yeah.
And that's again, I want them, even if they're not, I want them to have a shot and a chance to review. I don't have a problem with that. I think that's good.
Yours is strictly having to do with the caregiver.
Caregivers who might be the better parent for this child later on. But if the grandparents don't think so, certainly they should be able to say, wait a minute, let's have a judicial hearing on this and a review. And I support that wholeheartedly, but I just want them involved in that too, I think. And I don't know, you know, like somebody 6 months or a year, whatever. But I'm thinking in even different relationships, like I'm giving the example, I'm raising a nephew, that kind of thing, and I'm not a blood relative. So that's where I'm coming from on that.
Representative Boquist?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, I think I understand what you're saying. Make sure I clarify this, that because what we started out to do was to come up with a process to ensure the grandparents were involved in it. That was the key thing. And I see that implementation into the judicial review. And your definition of caregiver, I think, matches my definition of caregiver, which really has nothing to do with what we just heard in the statute. Your definition of caregiver in your context of using it may be another relative or guardian who's been taking care of that child for 2, 4, 6, 8 years along that line. And I'm in concurrence with that. I do have a problem with the definition of caregiver in the statute, because if you put that into there or you water it down to 6 months, no disrespect to Representative Flores, but the problem is we're right back where we started from. I mean,
but the grandparents are listed in there as we're putting them in there as a priority. I mean, all those as priorities, so that even though there may be no pecking order, they're clearly in there and they clearly have a right of review. And I think the courts, I would hope, would certainly look to the family if they could first. But, I mean, I can think of cases where people don't like their sisters or brothers. They wouldn't want their child being raised by somebody with completely different values, even though they're from the same home.
Let's see, Representative Barker, I have 6 kids, so none of my brothers and sisters want to take them if I die.
That raises another issue, Mr. Chair, about keeping those kids together or splitting them up. But and
the rabbits are jumping out of the box.
Let's put this one back in. My concern about that long-term relationship in foster care really isn't germane necessarily to what we're trying to accomplish here. It is a concern, I think, that needs to be explored down the trail. So
I'd like to comment, Mr. Chair. Something that resonated with me that Representative Flores said earlier is that it's probably most damaging to the child to be bounced around from place to place. And to the extent that we have a different standard for placement, and I realize this is not all the adoptions, the point of adoptions that wouldn't be affected by it, but where DHS is involved and we have a different standard for placement upon the child coming under the protection of DHS from what we have down the road under adoption, then that tend to increase the probability that a child will be in something on an interim basis after DHS steps in, and then there's someplace else after when adoption goes forward.
Right. Chair Krieger, Ms. Ledesma from DHS provided me with an additional statute that has to do with the judicial review piece that is under consideration in the Dash 1. There is apparently another statute in the ORS, 183-480, that provides any person adversely affected or aggrieved by an order or any party to an agency proceeding is entitled to judicial review of a final order, whether such order is affirmative or negative. And in the brief conversation I had with she and Mr. Travis from the Judicial Department, I believe their understanding of that statute is that it gives all of the categories of folks that we are talking about the right to seek judicial review of a adoption placement with which they disagree. I also note that Mr. Travis encouraged me to reaffirm the limited nature of the right of judicial review in such cases, that if a aggrieved party comes in and argues that they disagree with the placement because they don't like the individual who was chosen. They disagree with the individual's values, that the court is not going to overturn an agency decision on that basis, that it is going to be an issue of whether or not the agency abused its discretion or violated its own rules or another statute in coming to that decision.
Mr. Larry, I thought the other day we heard testimony of the fact that when a decision for adoption was made, that there was no possibility of review.
Chair Krieger, I think that may have came from Mr. Travis, and he may want to explain. I think the point he was making was that the court cannot overturn a decision as to a specific placement when DHS is putting a plan together. It can only disagree with the plan, but I'll let him speak for himself.
Timothy Travis from the Judicial Department. Mr. Krieger, there is no direct appeal back to the juvenile court to weigh one person against the other. The appeal that we're talking about that exists today is the one that you're trying to put into this bill, which is under the Administrative Procedures Act. It goes to the circuit court, to a completely different judge through an entirely different process. And as Mr. O'Leary said, all that's before the court there is, did the agency follow its rules? Not, is this person better than this person? So there's, what I meant was that there's no appeal back to the juvenile court to weigh one person against the other. And I'm sorry for that confusion.
Then this appeal that we've got here, that's different from what's in statute now for those people?
No. The appeal that you're trying to put into this bill is the appeal that exists now. It's the administrative agency, did they follow their rules appeal.
Okay. Thank you.
No, for that reason I support the original bill with the amendment.
You don't want to,
but Mr. Chair, in what I see here is this: a caregiver today presently has an appeal process, is what I understand. And so, having said that, if we insert, despite my understanding of, and I guess quasi agree with Representative Barker, if you insert caregiver into the statute we're writing right now, we haven't changed anything, because the caregiver already has an appeal and there's no first right. And so therefore, if the grandparent went to appeal, the only thing that they could appeal is, I can't think of anything they can appeal, because they wouldn't have been given a first time around look at it. So there would, the appeal process, frankly, would be useless if everybody was named into the bill.
Mr. Chair, that had gone through last session where we wrote some laws, and then the judges say, well, since you didn't say that specifically, that then it's gone. That's why I want to include them in there. I mean, we had an example. You lose your license permanently, third conviction of drunk driving. We have judges who are saying, this is your fourth conviction, I can't take your license because the legislature said after the third. So we had to correct that this time. So that's why, if we don't have it in there, I believe somewhere down the line the Court of Appeals is going to say, well, a caregiver's not even, they didn't even discuss them because they didn't want him included. And that's why I think we need to say that, and why we need to say grandparents. We put them all in there so that they're all in there.
Mr. Chair, then what would be the response in your case? Let's use the case you used, where you had a relative of stain in you, and you believed, what would be your reason for appeal? How could you possibly appeal as a step-grandparent in this case? A step-grandparent, and a caregiver was given preference over you, a foster caregiver. What possible right of appeal would you have, and on what grounds?
I just want to be considered originally. Just want to have the consideration originally, so that when whoever's looking at adoption says grandparents, blood relatives, and caregivers, you know, that have this vested interest in the child.
Sure. So then the basis of your appeal would be that you were not considered, and then the agency would respond and say, yes, we considered him, and they would have to provide some documentation, one would assume, in the court proceedings.
Or they could say, no, we didn't consider him because the legislature said grandparents, blood relatives. And you say, well, of course we meant caregiver. Well, no, you didn't, because you didn't say it. That's the problem. As I see it, I mean,
I just see it differently.
Having been beat up by the courts on a couple laws we passed last time.
I think Representative Barker and Representative Boquist are talking about two different things, and I think what Representative Barker is saying is that if we pass the bill itself, that he feels it important to add the caregiver to the language, giving preference to adopted placements in addition to grandparents and relatives, because if we don't, then the court may interpret it, the intent of the legislature was to exclude those folks from preference. And Representative Boquist's point is saying is geared more toward the right of appeal, and I think his point is it doesn't really matter if we put them in there or not, because the right to appeal is so limited that it's probably not going to make a difference if they're excluded.
Mr. Chair, actually, mine is twofold, the amendment and the original. My concern is if the caregiver right now has a right to appeal regardless. And so now all we're going to do is appeal to the court, and no one's going to have a first preference or a right to appeal, basically, because there's no grounds for appeal. And so you have to establish a, you know, first and a second. You know, is the grandparent first and then the caregiver second, or must they just consider them, so on and so forth? So I go back to the original bill. I fully agree with what Representative Barker is saying. It's just you got to fix the priority somehow.
I have a question for counsel. If there's already a right for judicial review, then for any person who has a stake in the placement for adoption, then why do we need a special right of judicial review added to this bill?
Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, I think the argument is that the dash one is probably superfluous in light of the separate statute that gives any party the right of appeal
or the right to seek judicial review. Sort of a follow-up point or question is that it depends on what the scope of the review that's being described here is. If it just means they weren't considered, and maybe it's a more limited review than the more general review that any party has now, it just seems to me it muddies the waters to add in this special right of judicial review as compared to leaving it under the general statute. I'm kind of looking for a little guidance out here, but I see some nods of assent coming from the gallery here. So that would be my thought, is that regardless of what we do on the main bill, that adding the judicial review right is probably not helpful to clarity.
Mr. Chair, in response to what Representative McPherson said, I think the only thing I would disagree on is that, like anything else in the, I don't know how many thousands of page to your left rear, most citizens have no clue. And so when they, even in modern day, they're going to be able to type statute adoption. And if it's not in the adoption statute, they're not going to know what their course of action is. And so it may muddy up the statute a little bit. It clearly makes a reference back to somewhere else, so someone's searching to find out. I mean, I had no idea it was an appeal, and I left the room yesterday or whenever it is, Mr. Chair, based on official testimony from someone who I thought officially knew the right answer, that there was no appeal process. And now we're told there is an appeal process, and, quote, we're all educated men and women and have been educated by fine staff members, and we didn't know. So I'm not sure how the public would know without it specifically referenced in there. On the other issue, Mr. Chair, I mean, I understand and would be sympathetic to Representative Barker's long-term care definition, but as the statute's written, no. I mean, I would go with the original bill and with the amendment unless there was a definition of long-term care.
Let me just try to parse that a little bit. I mean, and I was just listening to the caregiver definition, and there was an issue about an exception to the exception that carved out certain circumstances under which a foster parent was not a caregiver. But I thought that the operative language that would pick up what Representative Barker was referring to, somebody who had
a caregiving relationship to the child.
Part of it.
So I guess I don't see why that definition we would I was suggesting we cross reference would be a bad definition to pick up.
Follow me, Mr. Chair, because I believe, correct me, counsel, if not right, is there's another bill out there that would shorten that length of time. Is that not correct?
Chair Krieger, Representative Boquist, that's correct. The information we have is that this other bill that is on the way to the Senate floor would essentially change the definition, or I should say the exception to the definition of caregiver relationship. It would read it as follows. Caregiver relationship does not include a relationship between a child and a person who is the non-relative foster parent of the child unless the relationship continued for a period exceeding 6 months. The current language is 12 months.
But I thought that was all introduced by foster parent, which I don't think of as being... I thought there was another... maybe I need to look at the language there.
The prior language, I do think, indicated a caregiving relationship.
Yeah, that was what I was focusing on. The operative language here. I'm just taking a look here.
Yeah, we don't know.
Well, I do see, Mr. Chair, that this would apply to any person in a child or ward that has existed, and then the durational rules are not limited to just the foster child situation. So it would be one that would bear on the length of the time that the caregiver had been providing that kind of care, but it seems to me that's an appropriate standard as to whether that change from 12 months to 6 months would make a difference. I don't have a strong idea myself, but I think the idea that the key language here is in which the person provided the child award on a daily basis with the love, nurturing, and other necessities required to meet the child award's psychological and physical needs. And that's the essence of what we're trying to capture.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. We can answer with the caregiver. That's fine.
Okay. Mr. Lurie, how long would it take you to get an amendment to get the caregiver language in here?
I believe it could happen very quickly. In fact,
by 1 o'clock.
I think so.
Would that make you happy?
Good.
We want to be happy.
I want all my rabbits.
Feel good. So what does the shopper said to feel good?
Feel good, Bill.
I just want to show I conceded here.
Okay, we're going to close a work session on House Bill 2009, and we're waiting for some amendments. I might add, that's why we started early today.
Yeah.
Open a work session on Senate Bill 489.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 489 is sponsored by Representative Dalto and Senator Courtney. This is the bill that you heard testimony on June 22nd and June 13th. It would repeal the provision allowing appeal of public utility commission orders to the circuit court in Marion County, where they're currently required to go, and would allow review under the Administrative Procedures Act. It would also amend language permitting a petitioner to seek a stay of a PUC final order directly to the Court of Appeals for cause shown. The purpose of the bill is to streamline the appeal process of PUC orders and avoid the what some believe is a redundant step or superfluous step of stopping off in the Marion County Circuit Court. Under this bill, PUC orders and requests for stays would go directly to the Court of Appeals. And by the way, the committee already adopted the conflict amendment, and the bill is ready to be moved.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 489 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 489 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative
Gilchrist? Here. Aye.
Representative Here.
Aye.
Representative
McPherson? Aye. Chair Peter? Aye. Senator 49. Moves the floor with the due pass. I believe Representative McPherson, you were the carrier. Session on House Bill 2010.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2010 will require the Attorney General to create a child protection unit within the Department of Justice. This CPU would provide oversight of the Department of Human Services duties relating to the protection of children, as well as establish the process for seeking public input into how DHS is performing its duties relating to child protection. Mr. Chair, I believe the members should have a fiscal impact statement. It is indeterminate at this time, just because with a new unit and staffing from the Department of Justice, it is uncertain as to what the actual expense would be. And I have no amendments on this bill at this time, Mr. Chair.
I need a little further refresher if I could. I don't seem to have notes, hearing notes here, and I see that the bill was brought forward at the request of the Multnomah County Sheriff, and it tells the DOJ to do something, and I'm trying to recall, did we hear from DOJ and what their view is on this change?
Mr. Chair, did this come out of the Health and Human Services
mm-hmm.
Committee?
Originally, I believe, yeah.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes. The Committee on Health and Human Services referred it to State and Federal Affairs prior to committee closure. So it was
heard in that committee, but since I don't serve in that committee, I need to know. Does DOJ want this to happen? I mean, there's nothing on the surface of it that looks like it came forward from DOJ, and when we're telling them to do something, I'd like to know how they feel about it.
Kevin.
Okay.
Pete. Oh, Pete. I thought it was Kevin. Yeah.
Thanks, Kirby.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Shepard, we're looking at House Bill 2010, which is a bill that was sponsored by the Committee on Health and Human Services at the request of the Multnomah County Sheriff, and it tells the Attorney General to create a Children Protection Unit within the Department of Justice to provide oversight of the manner in which DHS performs its duties relating to the protection of children. And I just need to know how, since this is telling the DOJ to do something, how DOJ feels about that.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I'm sorry I stepped out for the moment. I'm familiar with the bill. I testified on it when it was heard in the whichever committee, first, I think, the only hearing on the bill. And I'll tell you, of course, the same thing I told that committee. The Department of Justice would, if this duty were assigned to us, we would undertake to discharge it as best we can.
Can you state your name, please?
I'm sorry. I'm Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General.
Thank you.
We provided, I think you should, probably should have it in your files, a fiscal impact statement on the bill. We indicated that it was an indeterminate fiscal impact, and that goes to a key part of what I told the committee when the bill was first heard, and that is we can't tell from the bill as introduced and as I understand it's before you, we can't tell what responsibilities you wish the department to exercise with respect to the oversight function that we would be required to undertake under the bill. If you wish us to review the decisions and actions of DHS caseworkers for compliance with law, then that's a matter and a function that the Department of Justice can do. We probably would need additional personnel to do it, but that's within the kind of expertise that, that's the expertise that our department possesses. If you wish us to oversee and to review the judgments that caseworkers exercise, have they made within the range of legal decisions, have they made a good judgment about the placement of the child or the circumstances under which kids are going to be treated or how they're going to be protected, then that is not a matter that the Department of Justice already has expertise to bring to bear on the problem. So what we told the substantive committee was, you need, you, the assembly, can help us carry out whatever duty it is that you assign to us. You can help us be successful in discharging that mandate if you will tell us explicitly what is it that you, how is it that you wish us to, what is it that you wish us to oversee? Do you wish us to oversee the exercise of judgment by the professionals at DHS, or do you wish us to determine whether individual decisions were or were not law compliant given the particular circumstances? And until we know the answer to that question, we can't give you an informed answer about how big the fiscal impact is. As to whether we want it or not, the Attorney General's position is that the state should do all that it can to protect kids that are under its custody and care, and we, if we're provided with the resources to do whatever it is that you want us to do, we will participate in that activity.
Mr. Chair, this is a comment, and although there may be a question embedded in there someplace too. I'm reacting in part to a long email I got from a constituent about this bill, somebody who's a retired CPA, and it's remarkably detailed and rather thoughtful in its own way about a bill that's otherwise about sort of governmental structure. It's not the kind of thing we ordinarily hear from our constituents about. But one of the points it makes is that the function of overseeing what other agencies of government are doing is not generally something that we ask the Department of Justice to do. It's really the audit function within the Secretary of State's office that does that more than anyone else does. So we would be asking DOJ to do something that's generally outside of what I think of as its mission. Great confidence and respect for the talents of DOJ, I'm not sure that this is sort of within their ordinary mission. And I think the comments that Mr. Shepherd was just making tend to reinforce that, that he needs to know what standard they're trying to apply in order to even know what the cost of performing this work would be.
Mr. Chair.
Flores.
Thank you. I wonder if the administrator could give us an overview, and for the record, it appears that there were four hearing dates on this particular bill and concept rather than one. What some of the concerns that were brought forward and expressed in those four hearings, and that would be point one, and just comment to Representative McPherson's comment that I'm not sure I agree with the premise that Department of Justice wouldn't be the proper venue for overseeing something of this nature. I would certainly disagree that the audit function of the Secretary of State's office would be a particularly appropriate venue for something of this nature.
Actually, Mr. Chair, if I could just amplify my comments. I didn't really maybe explain myself as fully. The main mission of the Department of Justice is to be the state's lawyers. It's to advise agencies of the state about what their legal responsibilities are and to facilitate their work. They're the state's lawyers. And it's a kind of an unusual, I mean, if I translate my experience as a private practicing attorney into that context, it would be an unusual situation if I were both counsel to a client organization and charged with an auditing or overseeing function for that same organization. I don't know that it would be a technical conflict of interest under the rules of ethics that control lawyers, but at least would be raise some issues of tension within, you know, what that relationship is. So I do think that an agency like the Secretary of State's office that performs audits, that's its part of its mission, would be a more appropriate place for oversight of what another agency of government is doing.
Mr. Chair, thank you. That is probably a very cogent expression of your concern. I'm not sure that I once again agree that the Secretary of State's office would be. I think audit is probably too light of a concern to address the issues that I think that we hear from, or I know that I've heard from concerns of constituents, that there are some issues within Department of Human Services and Children Protective Services specifically in how many of these things are handled, managed, or otherwise carried forward or carried out within the scope of their authority and sometimes question of the law. So that's why I would like to have some background from what testimony was provided in committee.
Okay, just a second, please.
I would also suggest if the Secretary of State had been doing what he was supposed to be doing, if the result was going to be what you expected, we wouldn't be having the problems that we're having ongoing ever since I've been in this building. It seems to be mounting more and more discussion about shortcomings within the agency. Mr. Boquist, do you have any comments on it? You're sitting here in a contemplative look.
Well, the operative word I see in the language is investigate. And so while I don't disagree with Representative McPherson's concerns, I mean, the challenge we face here is we're asking for an investigation, not an audit. And I see that throughout here. And thank goodness my little knowledge of this particular department, since I don't serve on Health and Human Services, I can see that it is a quagmire in basic terms. And so, my basic gist is I think it appears we were going in the right direction. I suppose, like Representative Flores, it would be interesting to know a little bit of background here. But I'm looking at the staff summary from the other committee, and it's quite bipartisan support that there's a challenge. They obviously had three hearings and knew something needed to be done, four hearings, and needed something to happen. And I just referenced the fact that, you know, you have Representative Greenlick and as a yes vote, and Representative Anderson, and you can't get the two opposite ends of the spectrum. So there must be something further in this that they saw merit in.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just briefly, the four hearings that are identified on the staff measure summary were, we had the very first public hearing, and at that time we heard from Speaker Minnis and Sheriff Bernie Giusto, which Cletus just passed around, the four-point document that Sheriff Giusto reviewed. This bill came to the Health Committee basically as one of Sheriff Giusto's to address his concerns. The other hearings that are identified on the final staff measure summary coming out of the Health and Human Services reflect that these bills were scheduled as a group with the Subcommittee on Child Welfare. So at that, when we had those meetings, we had a number of bills scheduled, and they were all spoken to in general. So we never particularly had real detailed discussion other than that first hearing on 2009 and 2010. They were part of the child welfare package as a whole. So I can comfortably say that this bill was not specifically detailed, spoken to at great length individually. It was as an omnibus topic around child welfare. But I do think that Sheriff Giusto's testimony outlines his points that could help with the Department of Justice, which I believe that's what Mr. Shepard spoke to or responded to at the first hearing in the Health and Human Services. Sheriff Giusto is very concerned about the lack of communication or the inconsistent communication between law enforcement and the department with some of the high-profile cases that the state has been addressing or dealing with the last couple of years. So he took his four concerns, and then this bill was a result of that, in a very broad, nondescript type of manner, coming from this intent of Sheriff Giusto. Like I say, I can just highlight the fact that the topics were discussed were that it's fragmented and inconsistent from the law enforcement piece. When the law enforcement officers are required to take children who should be removed from the scene, the investigation must not be, you know, compromised, but that there is a disconnect in that because then DHS, different workers come into play at that point. There seems to be no consistent central case management system coming from DHS, again, making it difficult for law enforcement to enter the premises or be connected when it does. And I see Speaker Minnis. He also mentioned that the supervisory component for the whole process as a whole, there's not really one lead at that when you have those type of, you know, when you're dealing with removing from law enforcement and then there's an investigation following, that's pretty loose or just undefined. Not that it's not done in a good fashion, but it's not clear. Now, I do know that the department followed up with the child welfare and spoke to, they also had a report. They had a national group come in and assess as their response to the high profile cases, and then the group, and I apologize, I don't remember who the individual was, but we had an official presentation of that report, had recommendations for the department on how to strengthen it. It was Ramona Foley's testimony at the time that they had every plan and had already started implementing some of those recommendations. I don't know how much more detail you wish for me to provide or...
Actually, Mr. Vice Chair, if I could, I'd like to direct a question to Mr. Shepherd. I want to just take off on this, something that just occurred to me while I was commenting earlier that I would like to explore. What if the investigation that this unit conducted identified issues on which there was a cause of action might arise on which the agency required a defense, would that put DOJ in an untenable situation to have been both in an investigative capacity on identifying wrongdoing that then, or the allegations of wrongdoing, let's say, that then would require DOJ in its capacity as counsel to the state and to that agency, therefore, to defend?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, let me answer it a couple of ways. First, we do have the role as the attorney, as the government's lawyer, so we do perform, of course, the advisory function to agencies. We do think that we have, as part of the duty of the Attorney General's office, we do think we have the responsibility of helping to ensure that agencies conduct their affairs in compliance with law. And so perhaps a little variable from the private law experience, when we identify an agency that we believe has stepped beyond the boundaries of law, we think it's our responsibility to say, you have stepped beyond the boundaries of law, you must change your conduct and conform to the requirements of law. And unlike the private relationship, there are legal consequences to the agency that doesn't follow our advice, in the sense they lose the opportunity for certain defenses if they're called to account for the violation of law, and there are other consequences for them. So we do think it is part of our responsibility now to say to an agency, your employees have violated the law and you need to stop that. Now, we do that in a couple of ways. We have a in our organized crime section, the definition of organized crime includes public corruption, official misconduct, and misconduct by agency officials that rises to a criminal level. And we don't believe that we have any conflict in prosecuting a state official who has violated a duty inherent in the nature of their office. So as to part of the answer to your question is, if we were to discover in any investigation of any agency, let alone DHS or any other case, that an agency had violated, in our view, a criminal law, an employee of an agency had violated a criminal law, we wouldn't view it to be any conflict to prosecute that individual based on the investigation that we had performed. So as to the extent your question goes to the potential discovery of criminal misconduct, then I would say no conflict. To the extent that it goes to, rather, the investigation in your hypothetical might reveal some misconduct that would give rise to a civil liability on the part of the state, that's a little more challenging problem, because then we have state interests that we have a state interest in defending the state against the fiscal consequences of a tort or other actionable violation of law. We also have the state interest in making sure the agency adheres to the requirements of law. And we have a duty to respect the confidentiality of communications and information we gain in the course of our investigation. Having said that, we often already come into possession of information in the course of our dealings with agencies that potentially would be useful to a civil litigant. We've been able to work through that. So I think on the criminal side, clearly no conflict. On the civil side, it's a little more complicated, but I wouldn't see that as a unique burden of this bill.
It's just giving testimony in regards to the response for Representative McPherson in regards to possible conflict.
Right, and essentially that I think I'm satisfied that we're not setting up an impossible situation for the department. It's really, I think the bill turns on, in my mind, a policy question of whether we have given adequate guidance to DOJ about what we're asking them to do, so that they can then give us a good idea about what we're spending when we give them this mission.
No, I don't think so. Question, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, Pete, I mean, you've obviously reviewed the Multnomah County Sheriff's letter. You guys have been through four hearings on this. I mean, it seems to me that while you talked about guidance, I mean, you have a clear understanding of the problems and the issues at hand here. Everybody wants more guidance. Being a former military officer, I don't know how many times I got, you know, just because it's stupid doesn't mean we're not going to do it. And so you get sometimes not as much guidance, but your department is much more familiar with this issue than many of us here. So I'm wondering, in your mind, is there ample guidance here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, my answer to that would be no, because the mission, even taking Sheriff Justo's 4 points as an example, the third one relates to there seems to be no consistent central case management system. The first one relates to the response to law enforcement. Now, let's take those two as an example. The Department of Justice does have some law enforcement expertise, and that some of that we could probably borrow and apply to the first point and help DHS create a system, if we receive that assignment, that provides a more coherent, regularized response to law enforcement. But the third one, relating to the case management system, the Department of Justice has no existing expertise in how to advise DHS about how to manage their cases, or how to direct or oversee and, in effect, hold them to account to some standard for the way in which they manage their cases. The question of how one manages a caseload is a resource choice that depends on priorities amongst competing kinds of cases, for example. And the Department of Justice presently has no mission and no specialized expertise that would allow us to help them at DHS make better judgments about where the resources should be allocated and where they shouldn't. And so the answer to your question, Representative Boquist, is no, I don't believe that this gives us adequate guidance as to the mission. You give us a clear mission that's coherent within itself, and we'll do our best to execute it with the resources that we hope you would give us to do that. But don't give us a mission without being clear about how you're going to measure our success in carrying that out. And my straightforward answer to you is I'm not sure what the mission would be if we took just the 4 points here.
Nothing further, Representative McPherson?
Well, I guess my concern, Mr. Chair, is that I don't think we ought to pass a bill that doesn't telling an agency to do something when they come in the form which they say it doesn't tell us sufficiently what we're supposed to do. So I'd have to say we need to provide better guidance in this bill before I can support it.
Any more questions?
Have no clue.
I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2010 for now. We'll be probably taking it up this afternoon when we come back. Open a work session on Senate Bill 899A.
Mr. Chair, the committee, SB 899A has a -8 amendment. This corrects an error that allows the county, it allows Multnomah County to establish a TSCC with public vote. Without the correction, it provides that Multnomah County would not be able to have the governor remove or reappoint its members or require municipal corporations to file budget estimates for their review. Also, with this measure, there is a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee. There is no revenue impact on this, and we've been instructed that we can rescind that referral to Revenue. This abolishes the Multnomah County Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission and allows the county with a population of 500,000 or more to establish a Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission if the county obtains approval of the county governing body and taxing district within the county.
Need a motion on the -8s.
Mr. Chair, move the -8s.
Representative Barker has moved the -8s into Senate Bill 899.
Excuse me, Mr. Do I have the -8s here?
They're attached to this.
-7. I'm sorry, I was probably wool gathering, Mr. Chair, when the staff was probably telling me exactly what I needed to know here.
But I can
the -8s again, refresh me on what these
are. Okay, the -8s, they're making a correction from the -7s that we originally had, making sure that Multnomah County can have its TSCC and that the governor can reappoint its members so that it doesn't abolish the taxing authority if we pass it the way it was. So this made that small correction so that Multnomah County can continue as it is. If you look at the engrossed of SB 899, the substance of the change, you'll find on page 3, it changes the reference there so that it continues as it was so they can have that. And then on page 4 and 5, if you look at section 5 on page 4, beginning with line 18 through the end of the page, and the top of the page 5 through line 24 has been deleted, and then the new section 5 has been added, which means any county and a took out that less than 500 may establish with the approval of majority of its electors voting on the question a tax advising conservation commission which substantially conforms to the provisions of ORS 294.605 to 294.705.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I, question for staff. The bill as it came to us from the Senate abolishes the Multnomah County Commission and then allows a county with a population of 500,000 or more to establish such a commission. So the bill as it came to us would allow Multnomah County to have a commission.
Correct.
So
it's receiving adequate law and updating law so that any county that has 500,000 or more population may have a TSCC.
Right.
But they didn't want to exclude Multnomah County from
that. But here's the question. Do the Dash 8s, as law stands now, my understanding is Multnomah County is required to have a commission.
Correct.
And the question is, would adopting the Dash 8s, then create a situation where Multnomah County still has to have a commission?
Okay. I have a proponent of the bill, can address the question.
Can you come up and please address it, please?
Good morning. Dennis Smallbone of Washington County. Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, Multnomah County, the effect of this Dash 8 is that it retains Multnomah County's TSCC. It allows all other counties to create a TSCC with a vote, regardless of their population, and it corrects a drafting error.
Right, so what I'm hearing is that as a result of the Dash 8s, Multnomah County is required to still have a commission. Other counties can decide whether they have a commission
correct.
Or not.
Okay.
Before with the sevens, we were afraid that Multnomah County would have to abolish it. That wasn't the intent.
Well, I wouldn't say afraid. I would say
they would.
Here's the problem, Mr. Chair. Is nobody has come forward with a plausible explanation of why we should continue to have these commissions. Washington County doesn't want the commission. Their aim is to avoid having a commission because the commission costs Multnomah County several hundred thousand dollars that it has to pay for a function that nobody has come forward and has effectively explained why we should have. It is, I mean, this is classic multiple levels of government. I mean, and I'm in favor of what Washington County is asking for, but it should apply to every county, including Multnomah County. Why are we saying to Washington County, you don't have to have this commission, but Multnomah County, you do?
Can you explain to us why we're doing this?
Mr. Chairman, Multnomah County's taxing jurisdictions are not of like mind about whether or not they ought to have one or not. And there was a high level of ambivalence, as a matter of fact. They did not speak to this on the other side, or now. So it's, I can represent that Multnomah County would like to get rid of it. The other taxing jurisdictions that are impacted by it that have to have a TSCC review their budgets are not sure whether or not they want to get rid of it. And I think that's a very fair representation of what's happened here, is that until the other taxing jurisdictions get to the point where they are sitting here next to me at the table saying they want out, then they're the ones that are under the authority of the TSCC.
Mr. Chair, I've heard from Multnomah County, and I have material in my file from Multnomah County saying they don't want a TSCC. I haven't heard from anybody else from Multnomah County who says that it should, that there still should be a TSCC other than the TSCC itself. I'm sorry. I cannot support an amendment that says that the effect of which is that nobody else has to have a TSCC, but Multnomah County has to have one, because I don't think anybody should have a TSCC unless they want it. And the effect of this amendment is to continue it in Multnomah County and let other counties not have it unless they choose to have it. I think that's unequal treatment, and it's perpetuating an extra layer of government at Multnomah County. And I can editorialize in this a little bit from prior experience, having been a resident of Multnomah County for 25 years before I became a Clackamas County resident, I was significantly involved in county government because I served on the County Planning Commission for years, and I had never heard of this organization. I just don't think it performs a useful function. And I absolutely agree with Mr. Mulvihill. I just think that it should sauce for the Washington County goose should be sauce for the Multnomah County gander.
Stand by just a second. So what does it do about Multnomah County that just allows them to do it?
Yeah.
Is it required in our county? Is there a long time it's required to have
it? You need to wait 300 years. First,
I don't see what it requires in this county since it's in the Multnomah County test if anyone to do it. So I'm confused. I don't see it. I don't see where it requires
it. Question, sure. Mm-hmm. Mr. McPherson, you say it mandates Multnomah County must retain it. Can you give me a reference in the bill?
I was relying on the staff explanation of the dash eights, but let's make sure that we're right about that, because if it was making it optional for every county to have it, I have no problem with
the bill. And Representative Ferguson, the way I'm reading right now, when I'm looking at my hand in Groves, it's not mandating Multnomah County. It's saying any county may establish, and it's deleting the population requirement. That any county may establish with approval of a majority of its electorates to have it. Am I interpreting that correctly?
The Dash 8 amendments retain Multnomah County's Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission. It was written for that express purpose.
But it allows
other counties, as they reach, as the public sees a need to create one, to go ahead and create one. So it just hangs on to Multnomah counties. And the argument I was presenting earlier is that the taxing jurisdictions in Multnomah County are not of like mind, that they want to get rid of theirs. The only one that wants to get rid of it is the Multnomah County Board itself.
Chair, I think I have this. What we're saying, down in the basic terms, is that those people who already have it don't need to go out and vote again and do it. And those people who want it have to go out and vote and do it again. Or do it the first time. That's what we're saying here. It's not saying, you know, it hasn't specifically cited. It says anybody who's already established, and I think that's the key operative word in the amendment. Someone who's already done this, already has one, they can keep it. We're not going to force them to go out, spend taxpayer money, and have an election to do this again. And those that don't want to or that do want to have it then would have to go out and do an election. That's what Washington County is asking. And if I recall, I mean, that was the intent of all the testimony of Multnomah County. We like ours. You're right. They couldn't explain why. But we don't have to go out and do it over. And I think that's the purpose of the amendment.
Right. Yeah. I think the operative language is on the top of page 4 of the A engrossed version. If I'm tracking this right.
Okay.
That in each county that has a tax supervising and conservation commission, levying boards, et cetera, et cetera. So it's saying if you have one, you continue with it. And the, what I would say is that this, the county government is telling us they don't need it anymore. It's an extra layer of government. They have to spend several hundred thousand dollars a year on it. Why should we be telling a county that says we don't need this thing anymore that it has to have it? That's my problem. Right, and these are this is supporting 899A without the amendments, because the way the bill came to us from the Senate, it abolishes the Multnomah County Commission. It says they can reinstitute it voluntarily if they choose, but so the Multnomah County supports the bill as it came to us from the Senate, but they do not want to see it amended to in a way that that requires them to still have it, but then lets other people not have it, because all the counties should be on the same playing field in this thing.
Unless entities within the county can't agree that they shouldn't have it.
Well, and I'd say at least I haven't yet been contacted by, nor did we hear any when we this thing came up for hearing. There was nobody who came forward from Multnomah County, no other agency or individual within Multnomah County came to us and said, no, we still need this thing. I mean, so far I'm hearing from the county saying they don't need it anymore, and I have to say that connected logically for me, because I had a connection and involvement as a public service commitment to significant things going on in Multnomah County, and I never encountered the work of this commission at all. So I'll tell you, it's not something that the residents of Multnomah County are keenly aware of or are following, and I think that the fact that Washington County doesn't want one is all the more indication why we don't need these things.
You have any further comment?
When I think that's all on the table in Washington County, all the mayors, Clackamas County, and the existing TSCC commission would support the Dash 8 amendments.
I just had a question. Did you say Multnomah County supported the Dash 8?
Multnomah County Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission. That commission, its staff, and its board that's appointed by the governor support the Dash 8.
They want to stay in power, doing what they're doing now.
It's on the 28th. I got it. The question once again, because this is the second time you got to come over, and last time you were up there with Multnomah County, and Representative Krieger wasn't here, and you guys, at that point, I think everybody supported the A7 amendments. Is that not correct?
That's correct, and then we found a drafting error. And the drafting error would reverse the effect. What it did is, let me draw out my notes here again. The drafting error would, without the Dash 8 amendments, the governor would be unable to reappoint Multnomah County's TSCC members, and local governments in Washington, in Multnomah County, would not have to send their budgets to the TSCC. In other words, it would neuter, if you will, the Multnomah County's Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission. So that was clearly not the intent of the Dash 7s, which was to have Multnomah County retain theirs, all other counties to be able to create one with a vote, rather than have it created automatically when you reached 500,000 in population. So it was an inadvertent drafting error, and that's why you have the Dash 8.
Thank you.
Representative McPherson, there's a witness sheet, and 623, and there's one person from Multnomah County. No Multnomah County commissioners, is that right?
I don't think nobody from the Multnomah County Commission appeared.
Yeah, it's from that group that wants to keep their group.
Yeah. Well, was it? I didn't actually recall that we heard from somebody from the commission, but
no.
The county commissioners
aren't objecting, or at least they're not strong enough to come here and say
something.
Well,
they didn't come in. You're right. They didn't come in person.
And you've got another group that came.
Well, but who was it who came?
Dave Boyer, CFO of Multnomah County.
Yep. Right, and I think he presented. He was speaking in favor of the bill as it came from the Senate. He was not supporting. It was Dave Boyer. That's according to my notes, and he was saying that they did not want to have the continuation of this commission. And he was coming on behalf of, because he's the CFO, he's the financial officer of Multnomah County, and he was coming here on behalf of the county commission.
And he's marked down here as being in position is for the bill.
Yes, because the bill, as it came from the Senate, would abolish the Multnomah County Commission. So what we have now is an amendment that would eliminate that feature. It would leave in place the Multnomah County Commission and would continue that, but make it optional for other counties.
You know, for somebody from Curry County, I'm not really too concerned what Multnomah County wants one way or the other, but I wish they were here to talk to us a little bit.
Well, but, I mean, Mr. Boyer, he was here, and I think Mr. Mulvihill will confirm. He said, we don't need this thing. We don't want it to continue. We want the bill as it came from the Senate.
Let me show you the only differences I have that they both supported the A7, which may in fact say the same thing Representative McPherson is saying.
I don't recall that statement, but I think Mr. Mulvihill, I have to give great credit to Mr. Mulvihill because he wants the bill to be able to get Washington County out of the soup, and the amendments will accomplish that, and it's to give his great credit that he's supporting my, helping me understand the factual background. And it's not that I want to stick this thing on Washington County, I just think that I ought to work the same for everybody.
Mr. Chair, I might add that this will apply to Clackamas County, or if not today, likely tomorrow because of the growth that's occurring there. So I'm concerned about imposing a mandate of another layer of government on my county.
I think we ought to pass out 899 without the amendment, and then we've got it. We've made this thing optional for everybody.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Unresolved for me is the conflict that the Dash 8 was addressing, aside from the Multnomah County piece. Mr. Mulvihill, indicated Scrivener error or technical error.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Flores, there's a drafting error, and what they did is that it ties, the specifics of it is that it ties the authority of the Multnomah County TSCC to ORS 294.710, which is that part of the law that allows all counties, other counties except Multnomah County, to create a commission with a vote. And the effect of doing that would be to remove the authority of the governor to reappoint members of Multnomah County's TSCC, and there would no longer be a requirement for the local governments in Multnomah County to provide their budget to Multnomah County's TSCC. And it was inadvertent. It was just 294.710 rather than it was stuck in there from it wasn't culled out from the earlier 899A engrossed.
And that's addressed, pardon me, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
By virtue of the deletion of language on pages 3 and 4 under the Dash 8 amendments. Deletion of language from the A and Gross version, those corrections?
Yes. Ms. Chair, if I could, I think what I'm understanding is that if we don't amend the bill, that the drafting issue that caused the A7s to turn into the A8s is moot. And passing the bill, go ahead and respond to that.
If you pass 899 as it came over from the Senate, then these other ones wouldn't matter, dash sevens and dash eights.
Right, right.
But that wouldn't, as it came over, it abolishes all Multnomah County's TSCC and allows any county to create one with the vote of a county commission. What we've done with this, with the dash sevens and dash eights, is to say that Multnomah County keeps theirs and they can come back at another time. All other counties get to create one if the public wants to put it up for a vote and create it that way.
Okay. And just to follow up, if I could, and passing Senate Bill 899 as it came from the Senate without any amendments would solve Washington County's problem. I mean, that's your...
Representative McPherson, yes, it would allow us to have what we came in with in the first place, which is a request to get out from behind the creation of a commission based on your population and let people vote on it instead.
I have a tendency to agree with you. We're going to continue this till 1 o'clock, and if Multnomah County, somebody up there hears, has got a concern, they better have somebody here, or we're going to pass out the original bill. We'll be at recess and down on the floor.
So did I. I'm totally clear. I mean, I don't know how we can argue right here. I don't even know what it's supposed to do.
I'll look at that. They have no...